This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show sex, love, and relationship coach and the founder of Find Your Feminine Fire, Amanda Tester. Now, what makes this conversation so powerful is the world of sex is really still taboo in many households, and more often than not, that can be detrimental as we progress into adulthood. So we discuss a host of topics, from the impact of childhood trauma on sexuality, body dysmorphia, hormonal dysfunction, tantric sex, the detrimental elements of porn, the first responder community, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible and important conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 950 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Amanda Tester. Enjoy. Well, Amanda, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to your husband, Mark, who was my guest a few weeks ago now. And secondly, to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, James. It's an honor to be here with you.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you?
So I am in Denver, Colorado.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your timeline. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah, so I grew up in Georgia, in Augusta, Georgia, which if you are a golf fan, you might be familiar. It's where the Masters is. And I have one sister who's younger, and my parents were, my mom actually was like a fifth generation Augustan, and my dad grew up in a small farming community in South Georgia, which so I got to grow up experiencing both sides of that, right? Of the rural, being in nature, going fishing and hunting with my dad all the time, and also being in Augusta in the city and all of that entailed. So I think part of my love for, I do have a big connection to nature, and I think a lot of that stemmed from being outside a lot when I was a kid.
Now, what about professions? What were your parents doing?
Mm-hmm. So my mom was a teacher and my dad was a commercial realtor. So he sold commercial real estate, mostly farmland, timberland, and all kinds of commercial buildings and such.
At that early age, was there an element of spirituality or a more open discussion on the sexual side? Or was it, like a lot of those generations, a little bit more behind closed doors?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, Georgia, well, in general, I grew up in a very conservative environment. And we were Baptist, Southern Baptist, so that's also very conservative. So it was not something that was really talked about. And I don't think it was, I don't know if there was a lot of shame that was intentionally instilled in me, but it definitely was, for sure. And I remember when I was in Sunday school, when I was a kid, there was one of the Sunday school teachers told me that I would go to hell if I held hands with a boy. So that was kind of the messaging that I got coming along, which, you know, is ideal. There's a lot of people too that are really affected by religious, kind of the way it shows up in their bodies, even in a loving married relationship or whatever it is. It's like that messaging, for hearing it for so many years, it takes a while to undo that fear.
Why do you think it is that so much shame has been cast upon sex when it literally is the very act that creates more of us people to then go to church?
Right. That is a very good question, James. I love that. So, I mean, I think number one, and I want to just honor whatever anyone's spiritual beliefs are, because I think whatever supports you is great. But I think a part of it is too, is the, you know, original sin, right? We are, at least a lot of the times in certain religious backgrounds, we are taught that, you know, we are flawed and that's our bodies are sinful and pleasure is sinful. And we need to, I think the Puritans really taught a lot of that. So, that anything that involves bodies or sexuality is taboo. It's wrong. It's bad. It's only for one specific purpose, not for pleasure, not for connection. I think that's a big part of it. And there's a lot of shame built in because we don't talk about it a lot. And the things that are publicized are often negative. A lot of us, the education that we got around sexuality growing up was very scary, right? We got, okay, don't have sex or you're going to get pregnant and ruin your life and your family's life. Don't have sex or you're going to get a disease and die. Like literally, I will age myself, but I grew up in the 80s and that's when kind of AIDS was coming out and there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of unknowns. There was all kinds of things. So it was really kind of a scary topic that at least I had a very fear-based education coming along. And I think that's changing now, but for sure, that's what I got.
Well, you start to unpack some of the people who were slamming their fists on lecterns, you know, and talking about whether it's, you know, the gay community or, you know, fidelity. And then you peek behind the curtain of their lives and you realize that they were, you know, closet homosexuals or having multiple affairs. So this is the kind of irony of a human, in my opinion, thumping a book saying they spoke to God and he said this or she said this, is that more often than not, the loudest voices aren't even living the very thing that they're preaching in the first place.
That is so true. I think, yeah, and it's even, I think there's a lot of statistics to back that up, specifically around, you know, that people that are protesting from the lines of abortion clinics oftentimes are very right-wing fundamentalists. And then a lot of the times those same people will have their kids or somebody snuck in because they have had that happen. I mean, I think that, I don't know the exact statistics, but I've read them, and that oftentimes with the abstinence education doesn't work, because I think that humans are human and we have certain drives, and depending on, I mean, I really do think it's an overall part of our holistic wellness. And when we can learn to be really conscious about our sexuality and be really conscious of our own bodies and learn to appreciate ourselves and other people and have a lot of consent and a lot of pleasure base around it, then there can be a lot of healthy experiences. The problem is when that doesn't happen, that's when things are more taboo, when there's more violence, when there's more power dynamics that aren't healthy. And then when people are just going to be curious and they don't have the education to know what gets them pregnant. Honestly, that a lot of times happens, because I think there's only a few states that actually require biologically based sex ed.
Interesting. And when you talk about abstinence, I think the perfect example is America with alcohol. Like, it was bizarre to me when I first came here that, you know, you couldn't drink till 21, But what that did was just pull that bow back so far that when they finally did, you had beer pong and keg stands, and you go to anywhere else in the world, they don't have those things because they just drink when they're younger. Now, it doesn't make alcohol right, and we all know there's a lot of detrimental elements to it, but you suppress that urge, you create a taboo that then sends people towards it. So mm-hmm. if you have, I would argue, open and honest conversations with your children about sexuality, age appropriately, of course, and I did with my son. And I tell you, it was the hardest thing to find a book. It's a simple book to explain to a young person puberty and as they get older, reproduction. And, if you have a child that maybe, is attracted to the same sex, then obviously these books talk about that too. But it was crazy. It was just so hard to find it. But that is it. I've kind of slowly had these conversations with my son, because when I was young, I grew up on a farm. My dad was a veterinary surgeon, and they told me that you just pray to God and he puts a baby in your tummy. And it was sex ed in school at, like, literally, I'm not exaggerating, 12, 13 years old, when my jaw dropped. And I was like, oh, you mean they shag like animals? Why didn't you just fucking tell me that in the first place? Right. It was all there just to tell me. But it was very much like, oh, it's dirty, darling, don't do it. And so it's so crazy because, like you said, there's so many examples of abstinence. I mean, look at the drug prohibition. All that did was just send people into the clutches of the underworld. It didn't fix the mental health crisis. So I couldn't agree more that, I think the pendulum has swung too far at the moment with this whole, everyone, is identifying as this bizarre thing now, and there's a lot of projection of a minority of people that's how we should all think and act now. But I think open, healthy conversations on the human body and how, we reproduce is imperative. And it blows my mind that we're in 2024, yet some cling so hard to Victorian mentality.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And I think that is part of the shadow around sexuality, is the fear and all that, the unknown. If people were more able to feel comfortable about talking about their sexuality, learning about their bodies at a young age, learning about pleasure, learning the appropriate places and times to do that, because oftentimes kids get shamed for touching their bodies, which actually in utero babies masturbate. It's like one of the things that they very quickly learn what makes them feel good. And so you will probably, anyone out there that's a parent has noticed their child when they discover this part of their body that feels really good, and everybody approaches it in a different way. And sometimes too, it's based on, well, how did my parents react to that type of thing? And it also can be, again, we're not really taught, how do we parent in a way that's sex positive? But, oftentimes kids are like, don't do that, or whatever they hear, versus, hey, that, I'm so glad that you've discovered that. Now, just make sure you go do that in your room, right? You don't need to be doing that out here in the den with all of us.
Grandma doesn't like it.
Right? It's like, oh yeah, that feels good, doesn't it? Like, do you just do that in your bedroom though? That's the kind of things we do in private.
Yeah. Well, even on the screen, I made this observation. It was really apparent when I first moved here, when you still had cable television, that you could have John Rambo slaughtering 100 Viet Cong, and that was absolutely fine. But then the top of an ass crack or a nipple would show and they'd blur it out. And haven't we got this backwards? The murder of people is allowed, but the body that we were all born in, naked, is being blurred out. Now, I get there's a difference between that and, what would be viewed as pornography, but it's to the point where, you can't, God forbid, you show an areola, the very thing that we literally fed from for the formative years of our lives.
Yes, I agree. And the violence is rampant on all the TV shows and even the kids shows. And I don't know, my kid and I were just looking, we somehow got on the topic of Frozen and the kids' musical Frozen with Elsa and Anna, and apparently there's going to be a Frozen 3. We were talking about it, and so I was Googling, is that really true? And it looks like there's some huge war coming and it's very violent. And I was like, why must this be what they have to see? I mean, yes, because that's the real world too, but it's just like it normalizes all the violence, but we don't normalize the pleasure and the good things as much oftentimes. So I hear you there.
Absolutely. Well, going back to your early years, what were you playing and doing as far as sport and exercise?
Well, I was not the most coordinated kid. I was very small too. I didn't have my growth spurt till in between seventh and eighth grade. And I remember when I was growing up, everybody was playing tennis, and I was not a very good tennis player. And I was a lot smaller than all of my friends, so literally half their size. And I think that's most middle school kids, right? You line them all up, they could all be 11, but they look so different in height and development and all the things. But I was a very small kid, and so I was not as physically strong. And I remember I did not like soccer. I didn't like getting kicked. I wasn't much of that kind of a person. So I mostly enjoyed playing with my friends. I did a lot of riding my bike. I loved to play outside. I wasn't much as much of a team sport person, but I did love just being outside and playing. And I would spend hours in the backyard and just like riding my bike and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I've had this conversation with a few people recently, and sadly, sometimes people downplay their activities like, oh, well, I wasn't college or high school level at sport or anything. But as you said, but you were able to play for hours on a bike outside in the garden. So I think a lot of countries still have that, but we've become so competitive here that you kind of almost like invalidate someone's activity if it wasn't for some league or cup at the end of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I remember even as a kid, it started to be uncool to ride your bike and people would make fun of you. And I remember there was an age where I just stopped riding my bike because it wasn't cool anymore. Then, of course, it became cool again, but it wasn't for a period of time.
Now, what about career aspirations? When you were in the school ages, what were you dreaming of becoming?
I think I wanted to be an astronaut or a marine biologist when I was little. The marine biologist was always so fascinating to me. And I grew up and, you know, we would go to the beach every summer and I loved the beach. I loved the ocean. I still do. And I thought that would be so fun to just spend my days like researching creatures in the ocean.
Yeah, the Clearwater Aquarium where the dolphin's tail, you know, the film is made about, that's not too far from us. So yeah, there are people here in Florida that do that for a living, but I think a lot of people dream of it. And then they, you know, the reality of actually being immersed in that and studying it diligently for your whole career, that weeds out, you know, the dreamers in us and finds the real biologists.
That's true. I think that can happen with it. Sometimes anything, right? Whatever we find joyous. And then when it becomes work, it's like, oh, how do we still maintain that connection to the wonder and joy in it versus just the monotony or like how much will I get paid or all the things that come up when it becomes real.
So when you look back at your early life with the lens that you have now, as we start to really understand the impact of our childhood on all things as we grow up, were there any elements you think that contributed to some of the struggles that you had later in life?
I think for sure the just feeling a lot of shame. But I do feel like, you know, my parents had a fairly good relationship. I think they, like everyone, had their moments, but they had a lot of love and a lot of passion. And, you know, I remember when my dad would come home, my mom and dad would be like making out in the kitchen and we'd be like, oh, gross, you know, as kids. But they loved each other so much and they had a good physical connection. And so they definitely weren't the type to shy away from physical affection in front of us, right? They were very loving. And also, I think just growing up in, I think there was a lot of expectations placed on me, like many kids, but I just didn't quite fit in as well into my environment, right? I was not as pretty and quiet and all the things that I was supposed to be a nice young Southern girl. And I just had a hard time with all of that. And so that made it challenging for me growing up, I think, to feel like I fit in.
Well, I think isn't that where the whole toxic masculinity conversation is supposed to be? I mean, it seemed to have been dragged so far to the extreme, like all conversations seem to. But just to allow a little boy or a little girl to wear the colors they want to wear and play the sports they want to play and not be defined as, oh, no, a girl does ballet and gymnastics, a boy does football and baseball. That's mm-hmm. what I understand as, you know, I think what people are trying to get at, but it just keeps getting dragged to some, you know, like atomic level feminism version of the word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I remember as a kid, I think it was very, definitely much more patriarchal. And I remember certain things seeing and being like, well, I would never marry someone who did that, or that's not going to be me. And I think that was, you know, I do love so much of the values I grew up with, but a lot of them I have had to do a lot of unlearning around for many years because I don't think that they're very healthy in a lot of, and, you know, I acknowledge like the privilege that I come from, but also the there was a lot of problematic things going on there. So that too.
Now you mentioned about growing up in, you know, the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and I was probably right there with you, a similar age. And I just remember being terrified when it came to sex and making sure that everything was bagged and sealed and, you know, everything you could do. And when I look back now, it completely killed the romance and, you know, and some of the relaxed nature that you would need in an intimate relationship. What are your observations of that factor? And obviously it was a real thing that was killing people, so it needed to be acknowledged. But how do you view that now as far as its impact on, you know, that kind of intimacy that we're going to start talking about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think like anything, if there are a couple things at play when we are going to be intimate or have a sexual encounter with someone, right? We have all the things that are making us excited and all the accelerators and all the things that are making it feel really lovely and turning us on and bringing in the arousal and all of that. But we also have the breaks, which are like, oh, will I get pregnant? Or will I get a disease? Or is this person safe? Or is this environment safe? Or all the things. And so definitely fear of disease or like STIs is part of the breaks. And so I think depending on your level of education coming along, that could be more intense in certain situations. And I think that that's just something too to think about, right? Like when we want to enjoy ourselves, I think I'm a big proponent of feeling safe. And I think that's the number one thing you need to be able to really enjoy sex to the fullest is to feel safe enough and to create a container that feels safe enough, that's consensual, that, you know, you've taken care to ensure that you are doing it in a safe enough way. And just like anything, like there's no 100% guarantee of safety, but you know, if you are, you know, get tested regularly, if you're sexually active and if you make sure your partners are, and then you like talk, you feel comfortable talking about it. Cause I think that's a big fear. That's a big part of our conditioning too, is that we are afraid to speak up in these really intimate moments, which are sometimes the most important times to speak up. Even if people are in long-term relationships, I work with a lot of couples where they can talk about everything but sex. But I think that is like when you feel, and I honestly, I think like younger generations are better about this because I think there's a lot more, there's better education in a lot of ways in some areas and just being able to communicate, but having that communication before, right? And just ensuring everything is safe before or safe enough for you to move forward. I think that's important and to be able to feel good about having those conversations.
So walk me through your journey to where you realized there was an issue for you personally, because obviously this is an important lived experience that then kind of spawned the work that you do now. So, you know, what was that kind of devolution of your own sexual experiences?
Mm-hmm. Well, I will say, you know, I did have some unpleasant encounters, right? And just a little warning there, but I had a couple of sexual assaults and that really affected how I showed up. And this can have often happen. Like there's a couple of different ways that this often shows up for people. And one of the ways is that they could potentially become hyposexual, which is like really shut down, really disconnected from pleasure, really disconnected from, you know, wanting intimacy or connection. Or the other side of that is they could become more hypersexual, where there's like more of a sexual expression or sex a lot or whatever it is. It's like the hyper expression of that, because it's kind of giving you some sense of control that's not really control. So there's numerous ways it can show up for people. And I think for me, it was more of a lot of self-blame and a lot of shame and a lot of, you know, again, being raised in that very religious background. And I was like, well, I'm definitely going to go to hell now, so I might as well have some fun, you know, that kind of thing. And so I did have some fun. And I think at the same time, I probably put myself in some situations that weren't the safest, but thankfully, you know, everything at that point, I was very lucky, but I do think those experiences affected how I showed up and how I would connect with people. And there was a lot of distance that I would put between myself and others. I didn't really allow myself to get into close relationships. And I remember the first really long-term relationship I had, it was very, there wasn't very much sexual activity happening. There was not a big sexual connection. That was a safety thing, right? It felt really safe to be with this person. That part wasn't there, but I didn't care because I was like, I don't even want that. But then I realized after years of that, that that wasn't fulfilling and that's not what I wanted, right? And I think that can be the challenging place, is where you want more connection, but then you're scared of it at the same time. And you want to enjoy your body, but you're afraid of what might happen. So there's a lot of things wound up in that. And I did a lot of therapy around it. And I think that's how I eventually came to this work, is I did probably a good 5 to 7 years of talk therapy, because I had a lot of things going on. I think partly from being raised in that really rigid environment where only certain things were acceptable, I think it's hard to fit in a lot of the times, which can lead to a lot of kind of behaviors that aren't the healthiest. So I would say, you know, like eating disorders and things of that nature, all of that I struggled with. So I started when I was in my early 20s, I was like, well, I want to work around these things. Mainly when I started, it was mostly around the eating disorders. But then after in my late 20s, when I was realizing like, I want a deep relationship, like I don't want a sexless relationship that is not fulfilling. And so after a lot of talk therapy, I was like, all right, that helped me a lot in a lot of ways. And then I went on to, you know, I was also I like to run and I like to do triathlons and I like to be active. Again, not the team sport, but the individual sport. We were laughing the other day because we went to our daughter's lacrosse end of the year party. And so it was parents versus kid. And I literally did not catch one ball. I was like, see, I'm not good at all sports, but I am good at the individual sports. So I found a lot of healing through doing triathlons because at the same time, I was working through a lot of this. My dad was dying from early onset Alzheimer's. There was a lot happening. So needless to say, I started changing and I think of that work of running and swimming and biking for miles and miles and miles really helped me process a lot because we do like that's one of the ways our bodies can process things. But I think after that, then I was able to kind of realize like, okay, now it is okay and it's safe to be in a relationship that is fulfilling. And that's, you know, it takes time to work through a lot of those things. So I just want to honor anyone out there who's listening. And one of my teachers says this that I love is we can only go as fast as the slowest part of us is willing to go. And that's hard for a lot of people because in our culture, we're like, we need that fixed yesterday. I want this problem checked off my list.
Yeah, well, especially this profession that's listening too. We're the fixers. So, you know, we show up, you call 911, we show up, and then within minutes, if not hours, then, you know, it's fixed. So, you know, now we're trying to fix our own relationships. And as you said, it's not going to be overnight like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, because we've all had different kind of experiences and those things leave imprints, like whether there's been a trauma or just anything that has affected your body image or the way you feel being intimate or anything like that, that shows up under the surface a lot of the times. And we might not even realize it, right? But it could be where we don't feel comfortable being vulnerable or where it's harder to communicate about certain issues, right? Or there's certain patterns that we go into around like rigidity or even being open to different expressions of sexuality or different ways that you could play together. There can be a lot that shows up there, like an unwillingness or more of a closed mind around certain things. I don't know how to explain that, but it shows up in different ways that are often under the surface. So, yeah.
Well, you mentioned about eating disorders. When you had the body dysmorphia, I'm assuming that was kind of up beneath, was it the kind of anorexia bulimia side or were you eating more?
So but mostly anorexia and bulimia. And a lot of that too, again, growing up in the 80s with all the, in the early 90s with the heroin chic models, that was the thing.
The waif.
Yeah, that's a very, and also I have to say like in some ways there a lot of that culture around thinness is just, it's not true, right? Because we realize this was, I mean, it's a form of, I think it's a form of controlling, right? We feel like we have to control every aspect of ourselves. And that's just another way that we try to control and try to make ourselves small and try to make ourselves fit in and try to achieve this like mythical norm, as Audre Lorde says. That is like a skinny white person, which is not really realistic of the real world, right? There's so many different ways and bodies. And I think when you're only shown one thing, that's part of the problem too, right?
Well, flipping that on its head, what about, you know, the overweight and obesity element? Because when I try and take any emotion out of it and I just look at a relationship and you have two, let's say, fit young people, and you know they start dating, and then let's say 5 years later they've got married, and then you know there's a couple of kids, and now you know because of the culture of you know not moving very much, the culture of the processed foods, you see a lot of our adults you know put on a lot of weight. in my kind of layman view, I would assume that that would contribute to obviously, you know, low self-esteem, but also just let's be honest, attraction to the person, because you were, you know, the lacrosse player or the dancer or, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to be, like you said, thin as a rake, but athletic and energetic when you were younger, that's when you fell in love. And then now physically, there's been a devolution. What are you seeing as far as this kind of discarding of health as the national philosophy that's allowing this to happen, the impact of that specifically on happiness within relationships?
That is a really good question. I think that, you know, what I see is that our culture is a very hard one to thrive in. It really doesn't support it. We don't have any time. People are rushing around all the time. You know, most people work full time and raise kids and potentially care for others or their, you know, parents or whatever it is. And especially in this middle time of life, that's one of the hardest times of life, because you might be caring for young people. You might be caring for old people. Maybe you are in just a, you know, there's a lot of giving going on and there's not a lot of time for taking care of yourself. So it really, and I think too, especially if you are a woman or someone who's had kids, you know, your body changes and hormonal changes happens on for everyone, no matter what your gender is. There's a lot of hormonal changes that happen in this middle age period. And so a lot of it's not easy. And I think that sometimes what happens is that we just get into these routines where we put ourselves last, where we're taking care of everyone else. And so we become last on the list. And unless, like, a lot of people that have careers where they are moving a lot or where they have more movement, then they have better health in that realm because they're not just sitting in a computer all day like a lot of people. But it is hard. And I think that for sure, there's a certain things that come into play. Like you said, body image. And then that disconnection that happens because you don't feel good in your body and you don't want to go out or you don't want to be touched or you don't want to be seen naked or you feel disgusting in your body, which makes you not want to connect. And also there could be experiences of hormonal shifts, right? And sometimes when you gain weight, there can be hormonal shifts, low testosterone that can contribute to depression and all. And there's other things at play. And I think when we look at our overall wellness, I think our sexuality is a part of our overall wellness, because typically if something's not working well in one area, it's not working well in other areas. And it can be challenging for people, especially as they get older, if maybe one person is staying fit and active and the other person is not. And I see this complaint a lot. Well, I am taking such good care of myself and that my partner has like gained 50 pounds and has zero desire to change. And I think that's the hard part, is when there's not the willingness there. But what I do see is that if one person is willing to make change and be empathetic and be a good example, more often than not, eventually the other person comes along, especially if you make it inviting and fun. In any sense, if you think about if you're a parent and you have kids and you want them to do something they don't want to do, like how do you get them involved? It's not like, well, you have not been cleaning up your room and you better clean up your room right now. Like that is not a very inviting way to do it. But if you're like, put on some fun music and dance and be like, ooh, I wonder if we could put all the trash in the trash can before the song's over. That makes it more fun, right? And so they're more likely to come along. So, but it is a big, you know, it's a big problem.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I just interviewed a researcher who's kind of very well known when it comes to firefighter wellness. And one of the most startling things she was talking about, and we're really focusing on the impact of sleep deprivation, which in turn creates weight gain, destroys, you know, the sexual hormones. I mean, all the things that lead to the cancers and the heart attacks and, you know, infertility, but also passing it on to our children, the pediatric cancers, you know, and the autism and some of these other areas. So this is, I think, you know, why this is such an important conversation. When the pandemic happened, you know, the most heartbreaking thing, aside from the people that we lost, of course, was that we had a captive audience. We had a beautiful opportunity to really reframe health in this country. We had an opportunity to take the terrible food out of our schools and put good food back in, just like we used to, you know, before industry, you know, to put PE programs back, to put more exercise equipment and parks in cities. But this is another layer. You know, we have, you know, a high divorce rate. We have a lot of, you know, issues when it comes to relationships. And this is a compounding factor too. So it's not just about the fact that someone's going to drop dead of a heart attack. It's also that someone can be a more active lover in a relationship or a more active parent for their children.
Mm-hmm. It is so true. And I wish that we there's so many things that need to happen at a early childhood area level that could make such a difference. Maybe one day it will. But I think that is true, because even from a young age, and I'm grateful for the school that my kid goes to is specifically a movement-oriented school. So they do an hour of exercise every morning before they start their day. But that's moved away from many schools, and there's no PE and there's no health classes. I remember even we had those coming along, learning how to cook healthy food. People don't learn this. And then also, again, back to that cultural situation of people having no time. And so they rely on convenience foods, which aren't the healthiest. And then they don't learn the skills to cook or to, you know, find choices that are more supportive to nourish themselves. And it's a kind of a vicious cycle. Like you say, it does pass down.
Absolutely. Well, while we're on the topic of schools for a second, if you were queen for a day, what would sex ed look like through, you know, the K through 12?
Oh, I think that's such a good question. Well, definitely for one, it could be more pleasure-based, right? And just more informative from all ages. And I think even when you start, I think it's getting better in some areas, at least here, because listening to the curriculum that I've been exposed to through my kids' schools. But, you know, even starting as early as like third or fourth grade, just sharing about your body and growing up and what that looks like, and to be aware. Because I think puberty hits people at different ages, and it can be really scary if they've never heard anything about it. And sadly, sometimes that's the case. Like, there's plenty of instances of girls that don't understand about their period, and they think they're dying when they start their period, because it can happen as early as 9 nowadays. I mean, so I think it's really just starting that conversation and also teaching. I wish they would do this even in the pediatric office from a young age. It's just like telling people, talking about their bodies and, you know, explaining the parts of their body so they don't think it's anything different. If I'm talking about my elbow or my vulva or my penis or my ear or whatever it is, that it's just a normal part of conversation, that it's nothing to be ashamed about or to have any kind of fear about. But I think that, you know, that will happen even when you do your best. I think that's why we have to do our best at home, because as soon as they get to school and they start talking about it in class and someone's going to make some comment and everybody laughs, and then that's another time when the shame comes in, or just that conditioning around, oh, well, this is something to laugh at, or this is something that I should be embarrassed about. Yeah, but I would say I would want them to learn about their bodies. I would want them to learn about the parts of their body. I would like them to learn about how their body works and really understand the anatomy. And also from a health perspective, like, the more we pay attention to our bodies, the more we can notice if something's different in an uncomfortable way, or that might be an unhealthy way. And so that we start, you know, just like you would brush your hair and, you know, wash your face, that you, you know, check out your body and make sure everything's looking good and feeling good, all even your genitals and all the parts of us. I think that would reduce a lot of shame around it too. And I think it's also sometimes a gendered shame, because I think more often than not, like, girls get more shamed around their bodies than boys, or at least they don't talk about it as much. I mean, I remember I was at a friend's house once, and you know, we were hanging out, and she was bathing the kids or whatever, and, you know, she's like telling her kid to bathe it down there, and I was like, why don't you just call it a vulva? And she was like, oh, I hate that. And I was like, that's what it is. Like, what do you call your son's genitals? She's like, penis. I'm like, what's the difference, right? Just if you don't even speak it, then there's a layer of shame that's just automatically there, right? So. And then also talking about, you know, what are healthy boundaries? What is consent? What does that mean? How do you really know when you're feeling yes and no? And how can you discern if it's, you know, you also have to bring your brain in sometimes when it doesn't want to be there, and vice versa, right? Sometimes you want to turn your brain off, but it's like listening, like, what is the really safe way to move forward? When is it, you know, making sure that I'm in alignment here? Is this a good decision or not? Yeah.
Well, I think another area is, you know, that I was just blown away in a very sad way, how many of the male guests I had on, especially that were first responders or military members, were sexually assaulted as children. Mm-hmm. And yes. So you get to see behind this curtain, and you talk about taboo. That's probably the most taboo thing for a man to admit, is that he was raped by another man when he was a small child. But it's a very real thing. So if we're not having these sexual conversations, you're not, you know, educating the child, as you said, consent, what's right, what's wrong, and, you know, to remove the shame. So God forbid someone tries to do it, they can immediately come to you and say, you know, this is what just happened. Because, I mean, I've heard so many times where the predator has basically said, you know, you got to keep this our secret, you know, your mom and dad will be angry. Well, If you never talk to your child about that, then they're going to believe that. But if you have an open line of communication, the chances of them getting away with something like that are a lot slimmer.
That is so true. And I feel really grateful that my daughter's school had a really big curriculum around this, I think when she was around first grade. And they do it every other year, but it's really around prevention, like child abuse prevention. So it's teaching kids exactly those things, what to look out for, and also as parents, and things to say and ways to kind of create a healthy environment, and even simple things that we don't think about oftentimes as parents when we send our kids off to play. Like if you're sending your friend to a kid's house, you're sending your kid to a friend's house versus just being like, you know, you listen to the parents and do what they say. It's like, if anything that makes you feel unsafe happens there, you tell me right away. And doing it in front of the other parent, doing it in front of the babysitter so that they know, like, oh, I better not try anything because these parents are on to me. Or that, you know what I mean? I hate to say it, but oftentimes it's someone that you know and there's a grooming process involved. And so it's a very complicated and it's very real, like you say. And so the more we understand, the more kids understand, the more they can protect themselves. And I think that's a big part of the education is then the more someone knows, the more they are aware and the more they can care for themselves, because we're not going to always be there. And we want them to be able to care for themselves when they're on their own, which is a big part of it.
Absolutely. Well, I want to hit one more area and then go into, you know, the healing tools that you found for yourself. You mentioned about hypersexuality. It reminds me, it was incredible. I had a guest on who had written, he was a bouncer back in England. And so he'd written books on fighting. And as a young, still small boy, you know, I was, you know, so kind of meek. And so I read all his books and, you know, it was this big guy with a flat nose and a shaved head. And years later, I do this podcast and his name comes up in conversation. I'm like, oh man, I should try and get him on one day. So we sit down and talk. And he opens up about the sexual assault that he, you know, was receiving over and over and over again by his martial arts instructor. And he was very graphic too. When he told the story, he talked about the hypersexuality towards himself. So the masturbation and some of these things, but it was, you know, it was almost that, so almost kind of self-mutilation to that point. But you hear this with some people, you know, whether they were, it was a young girl called a whore because she had big boobs and then has a sexual experience finally, and then kind of goes in the hypersexuality side. So, you know, expand on that a little bit. You know, what have you seen yourself or some of the women that you've worked with as far as the impact of trauma sending down that road? Because, you know, I guess in one perspective, it's almost like, oh, you've said I'm this person, so let me just become this person then.
Yeah. So I think a lot of it, you know, our bodies are really smart and they develop these coping mechanisms that at some point served a purpose, but then at another point, they're not serving the purpose anymore. But there's a part of us that like still thinks it needs to react in that way. And I think when it comes to hypersexuality, that could be more around like just expressing yourself without regard to the effect that has on others too, right? Even, you know, really wanting to be very potentially what our culture would quote unquote define as like sexual in how you dress, like maybe wearing certain things and expressing yourself in certain ways or having a lot of sex or whatever it is. It's kind of, but it's doing it from more of a an unhealthy place. It's like this need to feed this. It's kind of like there's a need to feed this part of you. And it's not quite finding the regulated way to do it. And just to so, and I'm sure many of your listeners already kind of understand this, but I'll just explain this really briefly. This really base nervous system explanation is that typically we want to kind of respond in our range of resilience or our window of tolerance, which is where something happens, like there's a stimulus, like say, for example, you hear a loud noise, you turn, you realize it was just someone slamming their car door, you come back, and just a couple minutes, your nervous system calms back down, you're back into regulation, you go about your business. But what can happen is if you have had trauma or have had experiences, you hear that loud noise and then it gets your anxiety going. You have this hypoarousal, maybe your heart rate is fast, your breathing shallows, and it takes a really long time for you to come back to feeling more balanced, right? That's kind of if your body is tending to that hyperarousal state. And so the same thing happens when we are kind of in that way in our sexuality. It's like there's that constant need to feed that and constant desire to to feed it. And in a way, it's to try to get control of the situation, right? It's trying to gain control of a situation that you did not have control in before, because oftentimes that's what happens when we are, if something traumatic has happened, right? It was too much, too fast, too soon. Or as one of my teachers, Rachel Maddox, says, I love her description. It's an embodied violation hangover, in whatever way that looks. So that's kind of how that shows up. Does that make sense?
No, it does. And it's interesting because from a male perspective, you know, there's examples where people were, you know, rampant as far as their infidelity. And when you look at the kind of the physiology post-orgasm for a man, there's a kind of deregulation of the nervous system, albeit mm-hmm. temporary. So yeah. Then they start winding up again, and now they're kind of seeking that as well. So you've got, as you said, the control element, but I think you've got the physiological response as well that the body kind of yearns for, which is downregulation.
Yep, exactly. And that's one of the ways that we figure that out in the not so healthy way, right? But it's like getting the result that you need, but not in the healthy way of doing it. Yes.
No, because there's probably a lot more stress on the other end when you've just finished and you look at the person and you're like, I don't want to be with you. I should be with my wife. So,
I also want to name too, like a lot of times I want to just give some empathy if someone is experiencing this, because a lot of it is beyond your control in a certain way. Like once you hit a certain point, it's really hard sometimes to shift. So it's really, really a process of learning how to maybe complete the incomplete stress cycles that your body didn't get to complete. And to work through, like, what is the root of this? And then that way, your nervous system responds differently over time.
Well, let's get to that then. So you found yourself in this place. Obviously, you mentioned eating disorders. You mentioned hypersexuality. You know, you had this relationship that was kind of asexual at that point. What was kind of the lowest point? And then what were some of the tools that you started to find for your own healing?
Well, I think I think that there was a relationship that, you know, beautiful person, but we just weren't right for each other. And for too long, I just wanted to leave, but I didn't, because for all the reasons, like, oh, well, I'm not good enough, or all the stories I told myself. And so I just made the decision. I remember I was at the beach with my family and I was like, this is just, I cannot live like this. I mean, I think I was probably 20 pounds overweight and I was drinking way too much and I was doing all the numbing behaviors that I could possibly do to not feel my situation, which was, I wasn't happy. Right. And I'm sure they weren't either, because how could they be, you know? And so I think realizing too, that I just had to stop and take care of myself. And so I did. I mean, that's when I went back to my therapist and I found a new one. And then I started doing more triathlons, and that was a really healing thing. And then I realized, through that I'm capable of a lot more than I thought I was. You know, I think we give ourselves such a hard time, or things feel so hard, because when you are overwhelmed and when you're shut down and have depression, I mean, there's not the motivation, and it's a biological thing sometimes. Like, you just can't make the choices. But I think with the right support, and if you have some accountability, then you can do it. And I think that it doesn't mean it's easy, but it's doable. And you just have to take the steps along the way that make it feel more doable. And I often relate it to exercise, because that's something I can connect to. But I remember when I first got back into running, like, I could barely run. And so I would like walk for 5 minutes and run for a minute, and walk for 5 minutes and run for a minute. And you do that long enough, and then you get a little bit more endurance, right? And then you can get a little bit more, as you know, from your training, like, you can ramp up, but it's not like you go out there and you just go run 26 miles, because that would overstress your system and you would totally shut down, and that would not be good. But I think that's just the reminder. It's like, there's baby steps you can take, and that is the key. And that's really how our nervous system grows, because we're meant to, you know, if we just give it a little stress, that's the point where it can find a different way of reacting. But if we overdo it and like stretch it too much, then that's overstressing, and we're going to, you know, take two steps backwards versus going forward. And I think that's what can often happen a lot of times with sexuality specifically, is that, you know, we want things to be so different. So we might push ourselves past a point that we didn't want to. And then we kind of like, if there's that shutdown again, especially if there's been trauma in the past, or, you know, there's a lot that you're holding on. And let's face it, like, when you're dealing with a lot of things traumatically every day and you hold space for so many things, then there's a part of you that, you know, kind of has to disconnect. You have to have a little bit of healthy disassociation to do your job well and to show up in the way you need to. But then there comes a time when you want to be intimate with your partner and you want to fully connect, but there's a layer that's like, can't do that because of the vulnerability or whatever else might get touched on if you were to allow that deep of a surrender. Yeah.
So talk to me about the journey from starting to heal yourself to becoming a healer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for me, you know, I did a lot with the talk therapy. That was so helpful in so many ways. And then through all the triathlons and everything, just feeling so much better in my body and just the power that I reconnected to just through my own aliveness, which I think is a big part of the trauma resolution work I do, is to help people connect to that aliveness again. And then, of course, I met my wonderful husband and we had a really amazing relationship. And then, you know, we had a baby. And I think after that, that's when a lot of things came back, which is very common, is through birth can bring up a lot of past trauma and things of that nature. And I just remember feeling, I thought I was doing all the right things for myself after my daughter was born. She was probably around a year old. And I just remember one morning in particular, and I was walking to the bathroom and she had this like musical train. I tripped over it and I was like, yeah. And I kicked it and I was like, oh, I'm the only one that ever does anything around here, feeling all this rage and resentment. And I went to the bathroom and I looked at myself in the mirror and I'm like, so depleted and exhausted. And I had zero connection with the person looking back at me. And I just remember in that moment being like, this cannot be my life. And I couldn't understand it either, because I felt I was doing all the right things for myself. You know, I was working out, I became a personal trainer at that point, and I was teaching stroller strides, which is this workout you do with your kid in the stroller. And so you run around and then you entertain your kid and you exercise with the kid in the stroller. So it was really great. And then I was very involved in my community. And of course, and my husband and I had a really good relationship. I just was so disconnected from myself. And I just remember in that moment that I made a little commitment to follow the breadcrumbs, whatever that would take to feel better. And I was not diagnosed with postpartum depression, which maybe that there was a little bit of that but I didn't know what it was. And so I thought, all right, well, I got to do something to change this. And so one of the things I did, I remember I started working with a coach. And that was the first time I'd ever worked with a coach. I was like, well, let's try something different. And it was amazing because it really was focused on desires and my strengths and like kind of going towards what is it that I want to do now? And I think if anyone, you know, if anyone out there has had a kid, then it's like this huge life transition. And especially later in life, because I was 38 when my daughter was born. And so it was a whole shift of like, well, who am I now? And I'm so used to living my life on my terms and doing whatever we want, whenever we want. Now there's like, oh, I have zero time and I never do anything for myself. And that was part of it. And the other breadcrumb I followed was this online course I found around like spicing things up in the bedroom. And I was like, well, that sure can't hurt, because anyone with a new baby knows that that's not the best time of your sex life. So I started doing this work. And I remember when I first started, I was mortified. Like, I didn't want anyone to know I was doing it. I was so embarrassed. There was a Facebook group. I was like, I would never join that Facebook group. I don't want anyone to know I'm doing that. But then I started doing the practices. And it was a lot around not just spicing things up in the bedroom. It was about connecting to yourself and really learning how to activate your own sexual energy and how to take care of your own body and really reconnect to what your desires are, even from a level of what feels good in my body, like what do I enjoy? And I think I had become really disconnected from that. And I just remember after doing this work, I felt so much more energy. And I remember even my husband noticed such a difference in me. And he was always like, oh yeah, go do your practice. Go do your practice. He was very happy with how things were.
Sure he was.
Yeah. And so I realized, I was like, man, why are we never taught these things? Like, this is nothing I ever learned. I never even learned about my anatomy, the capacity of what it's capable of until I was in my late 30s and started doing this work. And so I just, at that moment, I was like, okay, this has been such a drastic transformation for me in my relationship. And I knew, like, I want every person to know this specifically. Like, I was like, I want all the women in the world to know this. I want everyone to know this is possible. And because if it's possible for me, it's possible for anyone. And I think a lot of the work too had to do with, there was a lot of a component of working with your body and like really kind of, I had not done that before in that way. You know, I'd done a lot of talk therapy, but never around like being with my body sensations, or, you know, if I massage my body in this way, what happens? And realizing how much was still there that I hadn't moved, that hadn't moved through, that was really holding me back sexually and even just vulnerably with my husband. I like had thought I would open my heart to him, but that was, it was only probably about 20% open. And so that was another huge part of it that I didn't realize. So yeah, from then I started training with my mentor. One of my mentors, Layla Martin, I did her Vita sex, love, and relationship coaching. And then when I started working with clients, I realized there's so much trauma wrapped up in this that I want more in that area. So I did another 2-year trauma certification called Rebloom, and then also somatic experiencing, which really there the focus is to work somatically with the things that are the material that is stuck, that is keeping you from, you know, your full aliveness. And so that's kind of how I weave that all together and what I do now. Long story.
No, it's a good story though. And I think this, when I think about, you know, the last few years I've been with my wife, almost 11 years now. There were times I can think about it, you know, where I just couldn't turn my brain off, and therefore the sex was, you know, wasn't bad, but you know, like for example, in these particular situations, I couldn't finish. Like my mind was just completely disconnected. So, you know, it seems like that's the kind of the first go-to is just simply to address that, which not only is great for mental health, it's also great for performance on the fireground or as a police officer or as a soldier. So it's kind of ironic that it's the same work that affects so many of these different areas positively, including, you know, your sex life.
And I think just to name that too, it's like that once you have the ability, you also can discern when you want to fully turn it on and off. I think that's a lot of times people's fear is like, well, what if I, you know, start tuning into this and then I'm hypersensitive to everything, or I, you know, what if I get too sexual, or what if then my body's sensations are overwhelming, or all the things that people can think. And I just want, that's the beauty of once you kind of learn the tools and your body figures it out, then you can turn up the dial. Just like you're not going to be walking down a dark alley at 2 a.m. with your dial turned up to 10. You know, you're probably, well, at least for a woman, right? You're going to turn it down. So yeah.
Yeah, that would surprise a mugger, wouldn't it, if you just jumped on top of them and started dry humping them because you were on 10. So I want to just address one area before we go into unpacking, you know, what it is, you know, the tools a lot of us probably don't even realize when it comes to amplifying our sexuality. From my view, it seems like I guess it's bled into films a little bit already. The porn industry has done a massive disservice to romanticism and sexuality. And the more extreme it gets, then it seems to kind of open another dark door, which gets worse and worse and worse. And I feel a lot of, you know, young girls especially are thinking that it's normal to have these extremities, you know, sexually, that, you know, I'm sure 100, 150 years ago weren't in most people's minds. Of course, people would be, you know, have a spectrum of sexual experiences, but not constantly bombarded as the norm. So what have you seen as far as the impact of that world on some of the struggles that you've helped women through?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that is a big problem. And not only just in the porn industry, but also what we see in the movies, which is so unrealistic, that people don't really understand what it takes to have a great sex life, or they're very performative. I hear that a lot too, and I see this a lot in my clients, is there's a lot of a performance aspect versus actually an enjoyment, being able to really be in your body and feel your sensations and communicate what feels good and like enjoy your partner and all the things, versus like, do I look good? Or am I making the right sound? And that again is keeping you all up in your head, so you can't actually enjoy your experience. And I think too, a lot of what we see on porn is very unrealistic. Again, the other problem there is there's often a lot of unconscious consumption, like kind of like in a numbing way, which often is to get that dopamine hit, which we use many behaviors for. But the problem stems from if that's, you know, becomes a compulsive thing where you're just like hunched down, looking at a computer, having a quick orgasm, then that doesn't translate into connecting with another person. And then it becomes harder and harder for you to respond in different situations. And I think that can be a challenge in relationships when that happens, because porn addiction is a big thing. You know, if you have a compulsive way that you reach orgasm every time, then you might have to increase the intensity of whatever you're watching to be able to get the same experience, which is why oftentimes it can be, you know, unrealistic to what a normal, or not, let me just put that, I'm going to scratch that word normal, because I think whatever two consenting adults agree to do is great. and that is wonderful. But it's just like, if it's affecting your ability to connect with your partner, then that's when it becomes the problem. And I think there's a lot of things that we can do unconsciously that, you know, I just think about, my big thing is inviting in a consciousness to what you're doing, whatever that is, right? I think that's a really important thing I've learned from this work, is there's a consciousness to everything I do, whether that's a consciousness to how I'm drinking my coffee that I lovingly made, how I, you know, dress myself, how I wash my body, how I communicate with my kid, how I communicate with my husband, how I drive my car, how I show up in a sexual encounter. Like, there's just a different consciousness to it. And I think that is the, that's kind of one of the first steps, is you can just think, okay, if I'm choosing to do this, great. And there's a time and a place. Like, I want to eat this bag of chips. All right, I'm going to eat some chips. It's not going to be the end of the world, but it's more of like, what is it that I don't want to feel? Or what is it that's the point of this? Is I just want to like a release and I just want to feel better? Or is it that I just want that dopamine rush? Or is there, and maybe is there other ways I can get that? But what's the need beneath that? And I think that's the thing that we don't often want to look at.
Why do you think that rape element that you see so often from the male perspective, the demeaning of women, the, you know, I mean, there's no other way to describe it. Basically, you know, dramatized rape in the guise of porn is so popular?
I mean, I think honestly, a lot of it, again, is our cultural conditioning around violence. Like, we see so much of it. And I think specifically for men, oftentimes, you know, that's the only way they're conditioned to, the only appropriate emotions are anger, right? And that's allowed, but no vulnerability, no crying, no all the things, right? Because that's just not allowed oftentimes growing up. And so that makes it hard to have a spectrum of emotions. And so the violence one is an easy one to go to. And that feeling of power, of control, of domination, like, there is a power to that, but also there's a way to access that power that's in a more healthy way versus like, and I think too, again, if this is like a fantasy and it's consensual with both parties, great. But like the non-consensual rape, or like really that taking someone else's sovereignty, when we reinforce those images and those things, especially when you're in a heightened state, because when you have arousal, you're in an altered state, which it changes the way our brains function. And so that we more normalize violence, which is why you see such horrific things in the world. And people are just like, because they're totally deconditioned to it. So that's what I have to say to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these are just important conversations you don't hear very often. And, you know, I see it as a man, you know, when I, after my divorce, you know, I bumbled through dating in my late 30s and, you know, had some dates that ended up in sex and were so unfulfilling. They were consensual completely, but it was sex. And it was like, and then I met, you know, my wife, and, you know, here we are 11 years later, still as, you know, physically attracted to each other as we were then. So, you know, there's so much more on the other side of that human connection. I think it's an important conversation. So with that, then, let's talk about we always talk about the mental health tools that are available that we're not aware of, like psychedelics and things. Well, let's talk about the sexual, you know, growth that is available to a lot of us that most of us are probably completely ignorant to.
Well, I think too, because we're never taught that about that, and most of us learn that sex is, you know, if a penis enters a vagina and then there's an ejaculation, right? But that is just one of the many different ways people can engage in sexual activity. And I think that's what a lot of us hear. And so there's very little about, you know, women's sexual pleasure, or just even the extent of how you can expand your orgasmic experiences. I think that I read somewhere that the average sexual experience lasts around like 3 to 15 minutes. And for most women to be fully engorged, because we actually have just as much erectile tissue as a male body, it's just arranged differently, it takes about anywhere from 20 to 45 minutes. And so even just hearing that, people are always like, what? Most of the time, people aren't aware of that. And I think that is a shame, because, you know, obviously we live in a culture where we don't have a lot of time to explore the things that make us feel good. And so, but I think when you can just learn ways to expand your pleasure capacity, to be able to hold more, to be able to experience more sensation and hold the pleasure of it for a longer bit of time, it, first of all, makes for amazing sexual experiences, but it also translates into other areas of your life, because then you're able to have more capacity to enjoy what's good in your life. you have more capacity to really, I think, enjoy all the boxes that you've checked off. Because I think that's what I hear from a lot of men and women is that, you know, I work hard and I have done all the things and I'm just like not happy, right? Because I've checked all the boxes and I have the things, but I am not happy. And I think that is part of it is because we are just like go, go, go. But the part of us that wants to actually relax and enjoy has a hard time coming out.
So how are you helping through the coaching these, you know, women mainly kind of tap into those areas that were kind of shut down before?
Yeah. And a lot of this is it's learning to, first of all, I always start out with teaching people just some basic tools of nervous system regulation. And thankfully, this is becoming more and more mainstream because it is so needed. And especially, you know, with first responders is what does that even mean? How can I do these things? But it's things that, you know, that I like the term of like full body exhale. It's like the things that just make your whole body feel like, oh, what are those things for you? What are those things that help you just like kind of reconnect to the present moment? That could be drinking a glass of water. It could be taking a walk. It could be feeling the sun on your skin. It could be, you know, just looking around your space and noticing, okay, right now in this moment, I am in a safe space. Like I know where I am. And today at this time is, you know, May 16th at 12:07 MST. You can just bring yourself to the moment and also, you know, just looking around like, okay, if I look around my space, what are some things I can connect to? Well, right now I'm noticing. So like I will say, what are three things that you can see in your space that are pleasant or that draw your eye? Well, I have like this really sparkly gold pillow that I like to look at. And then what are some things you can name about that? Well, I notice it's like that, you know, kind of gold sparkles and I like the texture of it because it's kind of got this leathery feel. And I like the color. And then, so maybe you can look around, like what are some things you see in your environment and can you describe a few things about them? And then also you can tune in. And this can be the part that's harder is starting to learn the language of your body, which is called interoception, which is that ability to notice what's happening in your body. So can I feel the sensations that I notice in my body? Do I notice the temperature? Do I notice, you know, and the language of your body can also be called the felt sense. And there's lots of ways you can connect to it, right? Is there a temperature? Is there a pressure? Is there a bubbliness? Is there like a sharpness? Is there a bubbly feeling? You know, there's so many ways to describe it, but it's being able to tune in and notice, like maybe it's a tightness, maybe it's like a weight, and kind of noticing like, all right, well, I can tune in and do a little body scan and notice, all right, if I'm just paying attention to, say, for example, my arms, what do I notice in my arms? Well, I'm noticing my fingers kind of feel a little bit tingly and like I feel like kind of a cold sensation in my right palm and those kind of things. And when you can not only feel it, but then speak it out loud, that's connecting different parts of your brain. So those are kind of some of the basic steps that I'm like, okay, well, these, once I know these basic things, then I can step into to difficult territory. And now I can always come back to these basic things, right? So I can just like titrate in. I can add a little bit of difficulty and see how my body responds. And if it's too much, I can come back out. And that's kind of how I teach them to play with it. Because often then when we start to explore our body, we might notice, I feel nothing. I don't feel a thing. I'm numb. Nothing. I can't connect to anything. That's a very common one, especially when people start doing this work. I don't notice anything in my body. I don't notice anything, right? So if that's the case, then it's often just kind of learning that process. And how do you do that? Well, you start by just even listening to your breath and maybe placing a hand on your body somewhere and noticing, okay, if I have my hand on my chest here, can I feel the pressure of my hand on my chest? Yes or no? Is there any part of me that can feel it? If I notice it, what do I notice? Is there a temperature? Okay, maybe it feels a little bit warm. I can feel the indentation of my hand on my skin. I can feel my clavicle, right? So it's those kind of things to kind of start the process. And over time, it becomes easier. And there's practices that you can play with to kind of learn how to do that. And again, at first, it can be a while before if it feels numb, right? Because there could be a lot of numbness. And oftentimes, that is a process of just being with the numbness because that is also a sensation. And as long as it takes, showing up and like it feels kind of numb. And just noticing what about the numbness is there? Is it like an absence of feeling? Is it like a dullness? Is it whatever, right? So you just keep exploring. And over time, then typically what's on the other side of the numbness is like pain or emotional release, or it could be, you know, pain that lasts a little bit of time, because this is something that hasn't been felt for a reason. And your body, again, is smart. It's not wanted to feel it. So it's disconnected you from it, that disassociation in a healthy way. But then you want it to be there and it's not. And I'll give an example of this, because I think if anyone's breastfed out there, oftentimes your breast might be totally numb. I know after I breastfed, I could like stab my breast with my fingernail. I wouldn't feel a thing. But over time of like coming back to that, and with the practice of breast massage or just being present, then eventually the sensation came back. And now it's like a super pleasurable part of my body. But for many people, that can be an example of how that might show up. And so then it's like kind of working through that so that you can move through and start to find the pleasurable sensations, and then teaching your brain to kind of default to the pleasurable, the pleasant sensations that you notice.
Now, what about the tantric philosophy? Talk to me about that.
Yeah. And so what I love about this is because I think when you are talking about Tantra, oftentimes when we kind of mix sex and Tantra together, it's because of Neo Tantra, which is what most of us think about when we're like weaving them together. But it's really when I think about what I like about the Neo Tantra, because again, traditional Tantra is based in Indian tradition, and there's a lot of different lineages. But I think, again, the way I learned it is mostly kind of a mix. I have mix of neo-tantric principles mixed in. And so when you think about what are the some of the traditional ways of meditation, you know, hatha yoga, mudras, different things of like that are kind of what you would think with a more traditional way. But really a lot of it was finding the divinity in everything, right? Finding the divinity in the shadows, finding the divinity in, you know, death and destruction, and not only the good things, but in all the things, and kind of realizing that every part of life is sacred and divine. Every part of our bodies is sacred and divine. And there's a consciousness to all of us. So I think that like that consciousness is like the eternal principle of awareness. So when we feel into that consciousness, again, that's what brings more, it's like that energy that's in all of us, kind of that original essence. And that's what I think the when we translate it to having better connection, it's really finding that, like not only finding the divinity in yourself and reconnecting to that, but also the divinity in your partner and the divinity in all the aspects of your partner and every part of them. And even the parts that you don't like, right? Or even the parts that maybe you were taught were gross or disgusting, but finding the divinity in things.
Well, I want to hit one more topic, and then we'll go to the work that you do first, and go to some closing questions. But the last area, especially when you talk about Indian culture, that I think of is, you know, the Kama Sutra obviously is very famous, and you know, it's acrobatics with genitals. But there's almost, I would imagine, an element of shame if you're not doing bedroom gymnastics every single time you're making love. So talk to me about that, as they refer to the vanilla sex these days.
Yeah. Well, I'll just step back for 1 second and just, I really want to honor the cultural roots and nuances of Tantra, because there's, you know, so many beautiful lineages that have been passed down. But I will say, when it comes to that, you know, people think, I know this is maybe a well-heard joke, but oftentimes, because people will say that to me, is it like Sting and you have sex for 4 hours? And you can, but I think also you can look at it as like a gourmet meal, a 5-course gourmet meal, or like a quick fast food, right? So there's going to be a time and a place for everything. But there are examples and times where you might want to enjoy like a 5-star gourmet experience, where you slow down and taste every morsel of your food and just like, just revel in the deliciousness of every single bit of it, and the environment and the way the food's plated and the colors and the textures and the ambiance in your part and the person that you're eating with, and really just letting it seep through every part of your body and being, right? And that's kind of like maybe a more ritual sex experience, versus like there's going to be a time and a place when you're in a hurry and you might need to run grab some Chipotle. And you're going to eat it really fast in your car. And that works too, right? So I think that I like to use that example for sex too, because sometimes there are going to be like the quickies and it's just fun to connect, or just like have a quickie and go about your day, or you don't have time and you just want that connection. or just honestly, sometimes you might not be in the mood, but your partner is, and you're not willing, but you're like, all right, well, I'm sure. It's what, and it's not like you're saying no. I mean, it's not like you're saying yes when your body means no, but it's just like, you're like, okay, sure. I'll give this as a gift to you right now because that feels good to me, or vice versa, right? And so there can be those experiences. But I think when you can learn tools to expand your pleasure and to really work with your sexual energy and also understanding your erotic archetype, there's so many different ways to play to really enhance your experience.
So talk to me about Find Your Feminine Fire and, you know, what you offer to the people out there listening if it's a road they choose to go down.
Yeah. Well, really, Find Your Feminine Fire is all around, like, finding that aliveness within you. And I think that through our everyday life, that part of us is often turned off. And again, because we're going about our day, we're doing all the things, we're showing up for the people that need us, and we are leaving ourselves at the end of the list. And I think that Find Your Feminine Fire is around reconnecting to that. So it's really learning the tools. First of all, I mean, I love this kind of the overview of the archetypes of really what are the different layers that we move through to be able to heal and to be able to enjoy our sexuality to its fullest. And I think one of the easy ways to explain is kind of like the model of a plant, so to speak, because I think we too are a part of nature. And I think sometimes when we've experienced a lot of trauma, or if we're feeling really shut down or disconnected from that part of ourselves. And again, we go through seasons in life too. So I want to just really quick name that it's normal to go through seasons, right? Maybe there's someone that's sick, or maybe you're healing from an illness or an injury or cancer or all the things. Like, there's periods in time where you might be in a winter, and that's okay and normal. But if you've been in this winter for a very, very long time and you're ready to shift, then that's when sometimes some help can bring you out of that. But I think the first part of it is kind of really remembering your worthiness. Because again, that's a part of us that, depending on our upbringing, maybe we had a lot of neglect, maybe we had a lot of exploitation, whatever shame and repression coming along. It's like remembering that we came into this world as like a perfect blueprint of health, and, you know, kind of getting back to like, what are the things that I need? What do I need? Right? What are my needs? Can I connect to them? Can I ask for them? And can I meet them? And again, sometimes that takes some work to be able to do those things, depending on your experience. The second is kind of feeling the boundaries that support you, right? Being able to have sovereignty over yourself, feeling comfortable with the give and take of energy, and being able to know, like, what is healthy for me to move towards and what is healthy for me to stay away from? And how can I really feel that in my body and trust what I'm feeling is true? Because again, depending on your experience, maybe your body's telling you one thing, but you're like, is that really right? Like, is it really safe for me to do this? Or is this really what I want to do right now? And kind of really learning that. And often I will say this kind of can sometimes show up in long-term relationships too. Like I mentioned earlier, if you are saying yes when your body means no, again and again and again, then you're going to have a sense of shutdown or numbness or disconnection from your pleasure. And so it's kind of really learning how your body wants to be experienced, how you want to experience, and how you want to share it with others. And then also being able to express your whole self expression, because again, that's where the shame healing comes in. Because so many of us have a lot of shame or repression, or again, depending on how that shows up, is working through that so that you can really feel safe to express your full self in all ways, in all the areas, not only just in the bedroom, but outside as well.
Brilliant. And where can people find that online?
Yeah, so that you can go to amandatesta.com. That's where all my info is. Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, I'd love to throw a few closing questions at you, if that's okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
All right. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Oh, yeah. I think one great book that I love is, there's a new book that Emily Nagoski just wrote called Come Together, which is really great on just kind of understanding how to have better sex with your partner. And I really like the way she uses kind of like the blueprint of a house to figure out, how can I get the rooms where they need to be so that we can both come together and feel really good about it. So that's one I really love.
Brilliant. What about films and documentaries? Any of those?
You know what? Actually, there's a lot of good stuff out there on Netflix. So there was a great documentary that was really fun. I think it was called The Pleasure Principles. And it was like a little mini series on pleasure, which I think is a really good one. Also, Sex, Love, and Goop was another one on Netflix that kind of explores the erotic blueprints, which is one of the things I really like to teach people. And it's kind of like your love language, but for your erotic expression.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then next question, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Yes. You know who I was thinking? I really love Rachel Maddox. She's one of my mentors, and she speaks a lot to this. So that could be someone. And I also, I don't know if you're familiar, you might already be familiar with this person, but my friend's husband, Tom Johnson, has, he does a lot around fit to fight fire. And so on a side note, I will look up, because I know through somatic experiencing, there's a specific wing of that called SCOPE that really specifically works with first responders. And that's a great resource too. But I will see if there's a specific spokesperson I can connect you with, because I think that would be a fun conversation for you too.
Fantastic. Thank you. All right. Well, the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you online, what do you do to decompress?
Well, one of the things I love to do, of course, is have good sex, but I also love to be in nature. You know, just being outside is a big, big one for me. Live music outside, those two things mixed together is even better.
Fantastic. All right. Well, then we talked about the website. Are there any places on social media people can find you as well?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram at abtesta. And I am also on Facebook at Amanda Testa, Amanda Brown Testa. So you can find me there too.
Brilliant. Well, Amanda, I want to say thank you so much. It's been such an interesting conversation, very different than a lot of ones I normally have. But again, lo and behold, mental health is a big part of sexuality too. So, you know, there's so many intersecting elements of the circles again. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yes, thank you so much again for having me.